from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. More words of caution from China. This time, they were aimed at Japan, as China's foreign ministry urged that country to do more to maintain regional peace and stability. This was Hua Chunying at a press conference Friday.
We've said many times that due to historical reasons, Japan's Asian neighbors and the international community closely follow its military security policy. We hope that Japan could truly learn lessons from history, pay great attention to the security concerns of its Asian neighbors, act prudently and appropriately in military security, and adhere to the path of peaceful development. Japan should do more to increase mutual understanding with Asian neighbors and help maintain regional peace and stability, rather than deliberately escalate regional tension.
That statement came after Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe said he did not rule out the South China Sea as a potential area for Japanese troops to give logistical support to U.S. and other foreign powers under a new legal framework. Yemeni Americans who fled the intense Saudi airstrikes on the war-torn country are living under dire conditions at refugee camps in neighboring Djibouti. Press TV's Kanish Fatima has more.
The U.S. Embassy has reportedly failed to provide the Yemeni Americans with any assistance. They arrived in Djibouti after the U.S. said last month that it had no immediate plans to rescue its nationals in Yemen. Washington urged Yemeni Americans to flee the raging conflict by sea. The stranded people accused the U.S. of abandoning them by refusing to take any concrete steps to protect its nationals. Well, joining us on the line is our correspondent Yusuf Modi from Djibouti. He is among those stranded Yemeni Americans there. Now, Yusuf, just walk us through what are the excuses being given on the part of the Americans for not helping their own citizens?
Well, they haven't even given any excuses. I know that, you know, once we were trapped in the shelter here at the port of Djibouti, you know, I, along with other U.S. citizens, we got together and we decided to call the U.S. Embassy, call the emergency line, and tell them that they need to get us out of here because we are struggling. We are living under unbearable, poor living conditions. You know, people were sleeping on top of sewer water, and I really mean that. We were sleeping on top of mattresses that were on top of, you know, sewer water, you know, something that is just, it's a nightmare. We called the U.S. Embassy, we told them, explained to them our situation. And they basically just told us that we have to wait and we have to be patient. When you go online, you know, the U.S. sends messages, the emergency messages saying that their excuse is that they warn Yemenis, they warn American citizens not to travel to Yemen because of the political conflict over there. That's the only excuse that they have given. So they're basically telling the Yemeni American citizens, it's your fault for traveling from the U.S. and deciding to stay in Yemen. So many Yemenis, including myself, we feel that the U.S. does not want us to have these, you know, does not want us to, you know, share that aspect of Yemeni life, and that they don't want us to be living in Yemen at all. They just want you to be a U.S. citizen and to just, you know, carry on living in the U.S. without coming to Yemen. This is the sentiments that many Yemeni Americans have expressed in this journey, a journey which has really, it's been a nightmare. Many families which we traveled with, they're now homeless. You can find them in the streets just with their families and with their belongings because there's no hotels, there's no apartments available because of the overflow of Yemeni refugees escaping the conflict in Yemen. According to Yemeni officials, there's over 6,000 Yemeni American citizens over here, and that number is rising every day. There's more boats are coming with refugees from the port of Al-Mukha in Yemen, and as they come here, they arrive at the port, and they are, right away, they're dispatched, they're sent out to the shelter camp, and that's where the poor living conditions are sustained, and the U.S. Embassy hasn't done anything to alleviate the situation of its American citizens, and we feel that we are trapped. We can't go anywhere. Some U.S. citizens, their passports have not yet been returned to them, so they're stuck over here. They can't go
right
to Yemen.
Now,
they
Yusuf,
can't go
let me just
Yemen.
Jump in there. It is hard to understand the situation simply because the Yemeni Americans, at least, they don't want to go back to America as refugees or asylum seekers. They want to go back to a country of which they are legally citizens of.
Yes, and this is something we tried to explain to the Djibouti officials upon our arrival. However, they forced us into being refugees, and they were able to do that by confiscating our passports, and they didn't give it back to us when we asked for it, and that basically made us, placed us as refugees, and they took us to the refugee shelter. They signed our name along with our families, and they gave us these dirty, unclean mattresses, and they told us just good luck. We weren't offered any water. There wasn't any food. There wasn't any kind of medical assistance. I seen people passing out in front of me because of dehydration. You know, there's excruciating heat. The temperature reaches 110 degrees over here. And when you're placed in a refugee shelter without any water, you're just bound to be a nightmare. And this is exactly what we're going through right now.
A new president was sworn in Nigeria. We have this report from CCTV.
Muhammadu Buhari has been sworn in as the new president of Nigeria at a handover ceremony. He won the country's first ever opposition victory over a sitting president. And there's no easy road ahead for the former army general, who takes over a country with economic troubles as well as the Boko Haram militant insurgency. Buhari seized power 32 years ago in a military coup and was toppled in another coup 2 years later. The nation had been ruled by military strongmen until 1999, when civilian rule was restored. After that, the People's Democratic Party held power for the past 16 years, in which former President Goodluck Jonathan ruled for the previous five. Buhari's win in the March 28th polls came as a surprise to many observers.
Well, after it was all said and done, he won.
First of all, I would like to give compliments and express my gratitude to His Royal Highness Prince Ali.
That was Joseph Sepp Blatter, the embattled president of the International Federation of Association Football, FIFA, after winning re-election Friday, capping a week that saw 14 FIFA officials and business associates accused by U.S. officials of bribery, fraud, and money laundering.
A challenger, and he has obtained a very good result, and he, in such a situation, easy, he could have said, no, let's go further. Perhaps I would receive more votes. On the other hand, ladies and gentlemen, I thank you. I thank you that you accepted me, that for the next 4 years, I will be in command of this boat called FIFA, and we will bring it back. We will bring it back offshore, and we will bring it to the beach. We will bring it back where finally football can be played, beach soccer, we can play everywhere. But we have to work on that. We have to work on that. We have also to work on other things that we have to do for FIFA in the future. You remember 4 years ago, I had a lot of problems to solve, and I gave it to you, I challenged you at that time. I will not go into challenge you. But we have also to make some organizational problems inside the FIFA, inside the executive committee, because we must have a better representation of the different confederations and the number of members of a confederation shall have also their repercussion in the organization of the committee. And again, we need in this committee women. We need ladies. We cannot just say they are only co-opted. We have to do more. We have to do more in our competitions also. And I already told you, I will not touch the World Cup because the World Cup is too important for doing that. But for the other competitions, especially men's, under 17, under 20, also, we shall give a second part. We shall have a little bit more respect to one of the confederations that is respected by everybody. It is Oceania. They have only one member in the executive committee. They have only one slot or a semi, 50% of a slot. We have to do something for that. That is not good. That is not good for the, let's say, for the solidarity in FIFA. But don't touch the World Cup. I agree with you. We don't touch the World Cup. But now, and I have said it before, I take the responsibility to bring back FIFA. With you, we do it. We do it. We do it. And I'm convinced we can do it. I was not now in the room, but I was thinking. It was in meditation. I am a faithful man. And I said, now, God, Allah, or whoever is this extraordinary, whatever it is, spirit in the world that we believe, they will help us to bring back this FIFA where we shall be. And I tell you, and I promise you, in the end of my term, I will give this FIFA to my successor in a very, very strong, strong position, a robust FIFA and a good FIFA. We have to work together. You will ask me, what age? It's not an age. The age is no problem, I always told you. You have people, they are 50, they look old. Sure. Sorry. Sorry, I didn't know that we have so many 50 years old people here. No, definitely not. But ladies and gentlemen, you know, I told you at the beginning, or when we started for this election, I like you. I like my job, and I like to be with you. I'm not perfect. Nobody is perfect. But we will do a good job together, I'm sure. So I thank you so much. I thank you for the trust and confidence. Trust and confidence. Together we go. Let's go, FIFA. Let's go, FIFA. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you.
Blatter drew 133 votes in the first round when he needed 139 out of the 209 cast. The vote was about to progress into a second round when a simple majority would have been enough when Blatter's opponent, Jordanian Prince Ali bin al-Hussein, said he withdrew from the race. Blatter's re-election blunted what seemed to be a U.S. attempt to remove him. Political analyst Andrew Mercouris told RT that the timing of Wednesday's raid in Zurich made it clear what the U.S. objective was.
If we look at the timing of this, I mean, all these revelations and arrests have all happened on the eve of his election, Mr. Blatter's election, and the conference. So it's very difficult to see, regardless of the truth or not of those allegations, that the timing has been carefully timed in order to basically oust Mr. Blatter because certain people were not happy with decisions that FIFA had made. And if we look back at the last couple of years, the decision that has been most controversial was to award the World Cup to Russia and Qatar. That seems to have been the catalyst to this whole affair. The history is that Mr. Blatter himself has always been a strong supporter of the African, Asian countries in football. And he's basically broken with the duopoly that Europe and Latin America traditionally had in this sport. Now, he's made it more global, and he's brought in people from these two vast regions, and they're grateful to him, and they support him. The Europeans, who, together with the Latin Americans, have tended to see football as their thing, are obviously less than pleased, and that's why they're so strongly united in their opposition to him. I don't think people in Africa or Asia pay very much attention to what Mr. Cameron says. They might pay more attention, though, to what the United States is saying, which is probably saying quite a lot behind the scenes. And that is where the real pressure is coming from. This investigation was driven by the United States. The FBI was involved. And, of course, they are the real people who are pressing to get Mr. Blatter removed.
On Friday, the Palestinian Football Association president, Jibril Rajoub, announced that Palestine dropped its motion to suspend Israel from FIFA. That announcement came as FIFA approved a committee to monitor the situation between the Palestinian and Israeli associations. Rajoub added that he instead proposed free movement be ensured for Palestinian players and said he also wants an investigation launched into alleged Israeli racism and a vote on Israeli teams on Palestinian territories, saying the five Israeli league teams on occupied land should not be allowed to play. The move was welcomed by Blatter, who added that he thinks it is right to ban Israel, but that, quote, a lot of colleagues had expressed how painful it was for them to hear in this football family the issue of suspension, closed quote. President Obama's recent comparison in a magazine interview of the history of the State of Israel to the U.S. civil rights movement has the facts and history turned upside down. So says BlackAgendaReport.com's Glenn Ford in this commentary.
Like most politicians in the United States, President Obama takes on the ethnic and political coloration of whoever he's trying to impress. In the current issue of the Atlantic Monthly, Obama cozied up to Zionist writer and former Israeli soldier Jeffrey Goldberg by swearing everlasting love for the State of Israel. Again, standard behavior for Democrats and Republicans, but this time Obama couldn't resist dragging black folks into his political fantasy. If Obama wants to kiss Zionist butt, he should do it with his own lips and leave black America out of it. Obama told Goldberg he sees a direct line between supporting the right of the Jewish people to have a homeland and to feel safe and free of discrimination and persecution, and the right of African Americans to vote and have equal protection under the law. In Obama's mind, these things are indivisible. By equating the Zionist state's racial and religious policies with the U.S. civil rights movement, Obama is committing the gravest slander against African Americans. You might call it a blood libel. Israel is a full-fledged apartheid state, the only such governmental deformity left in the world since the demise of the white South African regime, Israel's close partner in crime two decades ago. Black and white South Africans are well aware that Israel is the last bastion of the racially based state. Bishop Desmond Tutu, who supports boycotts and economic sanctions against Israel, says segregation on Israeli highways and in housing reminds him so much of conditions blacks experience under white rule in his own country. White South African John Dugard, a former United Nations Special Rapporteur, says Israel's crimes are infinitely worse than those committed by the apartheid regime in South Africa. Indeed, an article in the popular Israeli newspaper Haaretz points out that the Zionist state has elements of both petty and grand apartheid. Petty apartheid, ineffective segregation in public accommodations and transportation, and grand apartheid in terms of where people are allowed to live and work, especially on the occupied West Bank. The Israeli government hastily canceled a plan to segregate Jewish settlers and Palestinians on a bus line into the West Bank earlier this month, fearing the publicity would invoke memories of Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycott, as it should. The United States was the world's first apartheid state and remains a deeply segregated country whose politics are dominated by white racism. So much so that a black U.S. president cannot figure out a way to defend Israel without reference to black America. In the sickest of political contortions, Obama invoked the U.S. civil rights movement as a way of holding out hope that Israel can break away from a deeper descent into apartheid by following the U.S. example, which is not good news for the Palestinians. In 1975, the United Nations General Assembly declared that Zionism is a form of racism and racial discrimination. The resolution was revoked after the Soviet Union dissolved, but it remains true nonetheless. Civilization demands that the Zionist state be dismantled, root and branch. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
This weekend, we'll see the 2015 Left Forum take place in New York. The forum is the largest annual conference of left and progressive intellectuals, activists, academics, and organizations coming together to engage in a wide range of perspectives on the world. Among the presenters will be Sarah Flounders of the International Action Center. We spoke with her via Skype from New York Friday. Sarah, tell us what you and IAC will be doing at the Left Forum this weekend.
Well, there are a few panels, I think, that are of interest, starting tomorrow morning, 10 a.m., a very interesting discussion with the Boston school bus drivers taking on Goliath, union power. And that's going to be in room 1.125 at 10 a.m. And that is a whole group of the union leadership who were fired en masse in an effort to break the union and have fought back, won overwhelmingly a union election, pushed this effort to break the union back. And they're going to be talking about the links in making a fighting trade union. So that's at 10 a.m. tomorrow.
That's the that's the school bus drivers?
Yes, okay. Boston School Bus Drivers Union.
Right. Okay, and then
taking on Goliath. And it's both they're fighting the city and, of course, this international union-breaking corporation, Veolia. And these are largely Haitian, Cape Verdean, African-American union bus drivers.
That's interesting.
So that's at 10 a.m. Also at 10 a.m., I'm participating in a panel with United National Anti-War Coalition on why we focus on U.S. imperialist wars. And we're talking about everything from the expansion of NATO, the enormous threat in the Ukraine, to the war on ISIS, and how really the U.S. is on one hand absolutely supporting and doing everything it can for Saudi Arabia's arming and organizing of ISIS, to the phony bombing that hasn't taken place against ISIS. So we're talking about the war in Syria, Yemen and Ukraine, and the pivot to Asia. So that's going to be an interesting topic, and that's also 10 a.m. To noon tomorrow.
Yeah, what else?
Okay, in the evening from 5 to 7 o'clock is Empire in Crisis, and Uniting the Struggles to defeat Racist Terror, Austerity, and Endless War, and Ramiro Funes, who is with FIST, Fight Imperialism, Stand Together, and Honduran Resistencia is speaking there. Abayumi Azikwe with Pan-Africa Newswire, Teresa Gutierrez, and myself are both in that panel.
And that one kind of is almost like a follow-up to the work of the UNAC conference, right, where basically the idea was to join the war at home and the war abroad.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Because it's the same war. And when we talk about the wars internationally, unless we're talking about the wars that come home in the attacks on Black people right here, on Black and brown people, on people of color, on the prison industrial complex, and on the enormous cutbacks right here at home, we're not really talking about the wars as they're unfolding in the reality of today. Now, in the afternoon, by the way, at the same time, there's also a panel, Land Grabs, Forced Displacement, and Political Violence from Honduras, Venezuela, Colombia. That's going to be important panels, and that's at 5 to 7 tomorrow. Sunday, again, very interesting discussions beginning in the morning, 10 a.m., with a discussion called Anti-Imperialism, a Debate, And it really is hosted by FIST, by Imperialism Stand Together. It has a number of young activists talking about the importance, again, of focusing on U.S. wars, endless wars, and how it has to be connected right here. Then there's a panel at noon to 2 p.m. called The Wars Come Home. And this includes Margaret Kimberly from Black Agenda Report, Abby Yumi from Pan-Africa Newswire, and the Michigan Committee Against War and Injustice, where they've been fighting water turnoffs and massive displacement from the city of Detroit through foreclosures. Marilyn Levin from UNAC is also part of that, and Ojamo Baraka, very important as a guest lecturer and part of Black Agenda Report.
Yeah, they're talking, there's tens of thousands of people without without water in Detroit that were just shut off by the city.
It really is a plan to expropriate largely Black home ownership in Detroit. An important gain won through the union struggle, through UAW, through years in auto and steel, and mass expropriate through foreclosures and now literally through water shutoffs. People who've owned their home for a generation and more are now finding it's no longer literally viable when the city shuts off the water. And whole areas become depopulated or just being clear cut. It's an outrage. And it's a real example of the wars coming home. By the way, just to say, 3:30 there's to 5:30 there's a panel, the 90th anniversary of the birth of Malcolm X, and talking about the national question behind the Black Lives Matter uprising. And Larry Holmes and Monica Moorhead will be part of that.
Nice.
And Ramiro Funes, a number of panelists having that's an important discussion also. These are the ones that come to mind in terms of, I think, where there's a discussion about the impact of U.S. policy and what that means here at home, and that the wars are insidious, expanding, aggressive all over the world, and increasingly aggressive right here at home.
And we close with a little music of the left to mark this weekend's Left Forum.
Rise, ye workers, from your slumber. Arise, ye prisoners of want. That's right. For reason in revolt now thunder. Chains of hatred, greed, and fear. Away with all your superstitions. Serve our masses. Arise, arise. We'll change henceforth the old tradition and spurn the dust to win the prize. So comrades, come on and rally. Then the last fight, let us face. The international unites the whole darn human race. So comrades, come on, let's go rally. And the last fight, let us face. The international unites the whole darn human race. No more deluded by reaction. Tyrants only will make war. The soldiers too will take strike action. They'll break ranks and fight no more. And if those cannibals keep trying to sacrifice us to their pride, each at the forge must do their duty, and we'll strike while the iron is hot. So comrades, come on, let's go rally. And the last fight, let us face. The international unites the whole beautiful human race. So comrades, come on, let's go rally. Ha! And the last fight, let us face. The international unites the whole.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.